Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Well, you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed,
your
I think.
Better half.
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, let's not go too
my
far.
My beloved co-host.
Let's not go too far with that. Right. But we, now, can, we can go, yeah.
Joining us in the studio today is Bill Timmerman. He's got one of his reports. This one's on surveillance, national security, civil liberties, what we know and what we don't know. The thing about intelligence, the real key to it, is knowing something about your opponents or enemies that they don't know you know. Because if they know, the worst situation you could possibly be in is you think you know something about them, but they've manipulated what you know. And, you know, and so you're in more trouble than if you thought you didn't know, if you didn't know what you thought about them. So.
Oh, that's very clear, Steve.
It's, well, it's
not
clear.
You cleared up surveillance for us.
It's a very intricate game. If, and I think you'll find intelligence people are terribly frightened about methods. Their methods being exposed is a bigger deal than a piece of intelligence.
And Bill's going to talk a lot about methods this morning.
And so that's what Bill's going to talk about. It's signals intelligence is the old word for it. It's been around for a long time. You study your opponents or enemies' communications to find out what they're doing. And it's blossomed, or what would you, what's a better word, metastasized into this gigantic, huge
word.
Well, it's controversial, as your choice of those two words is a clear indication of what's actually going on. And the reason why this, we're doing this now, we're trying to figure out what exactly is known and not known about government monitoring and analysis of telecommunications is, of course, the revelations by Edward Snowden, who was a former data analyst with the Booz Allen Hamilton Corporation. Booz Allen is a private company under contract to the NSA to analyze the telecommunications data that are collected by the agency from telephone and internet sources, and that includes fixed line mobile and voice over IP telephone calls, email exchanges, tweets, Facebook posts, online chat services. And Snowden has made some claims about what the government is doing, and the government has denied them substantially. And but there's a huge amount of controversy between people who are worried about our security and people who are worried about our civil liberties about whether or not these government programs violate the search and prohibition against unreasonable search and seizures in the Fourth Amendment, and whether or not they're legal under existing Foreign Intelligence Security Act legislation.
The Fourth Amendment stuff is huge, and we'll talk about that, I guess.
And then,
well, unreasonable,
not always observed either, particularly during wartime.
Unreasonable is the key word. We, you know, the government insists that what they're doing is reasonable. Civil liberties people feel that it isn't. But
and I don't want to mess up your flow here, so keep on. But what we talked before about. They're listening. It's everything. We're talking about. You said something about getting into the backbone of the internet and listening. And
well, this all started. Let's go to the beginning.
Okay, go ahead.
Now there have been very sophisticated means of monitoring telecommunications for years. I mean, people used to cut down telephone wires in the 19th century and
listen in,
splice them in, and listen to the key stream of data coming from the clicking from the telegraphs. And, you know, we had a famous case where an American submarine was fitted out with equipment to tap into an undersea cable in Russia that went between their naval headquarters and their fleet. And, you know, so this has been going on for a long time. But 9/11, you know, it's fashionable to say that 9/11 changed everything. When it comes to telecommunications surveillance, it did in fact change everything. I mean, the short answer is yes, it changed a lot. One of the things that the attacks gave everybody headaches about was that it was brought home to us that enemies who have no conventional military capabilities could leverage our own technologies against us. I mean, 19 men with box cutters could bring down the World Trade Center's towers, directly attack the Pentagon, and kill almost 3,000 people. But what was worse is that unlike conventional enemies, these people could actually be hidden inside the United States or an allied country. So a lot of these folks trained to fly airplanes in Florida and were headquartered, in fact, in Germany. And there's no easy way to identify them. They don't wear uniforms. They don't stay in one place. And within the United States, they're hard to distinguish from American citizens or from tourists or from whatever. Some of them could even be U.S. citizens who have sympathies that we don't know about that came from their country of origin. You know, we have had some examples of Muslim American citizens who become convinced that, you know, that U.S. is the enemy of Islam and have acted accordingly. The most recent one was the Boston bombing. So how is the government supposed to identify and track them? Well, it's very hard to get inside these groups because, of course, we don't have a lot of people who look like them and speak Arabic fluently and have cultural backgrounds that are similar to theirs. So they're much harder to infiltrate, say, for example, than even the Russians were or the Germans.
So what choice have we made?
Well, the first line of defense was to monitor communications. Because we want to identify them before they attack us. After they attack us doesn't help very much when you consider the kind of damage that they can do, you know, with modern explosives, with, you know, there's even some thought that they might get their hands on a nuclear weapon. And, you know, that was probably not completely crazy because we did have a guy in Pakistan that was supplying nuclear technology to other countries and who offered them to terrorist organizations, Mr. Khan, right? So reacting to this, what they decided to do was that computers and computer storage were advanced enough at this point that they could simply vacuum up all of the worldwide telecommunications data, store it, and then use very powerful computers to run pattern analysis on it to see if they could identify connections between people that might indicate that they would be planning a terrorist attack. And, you know, this was a clear emergency, and when intelligence agencies asked for this capability, they were given administrative permission to go ahead with it because everybody was waiting for the other shoe to drop. Remember, we had not only the 9/11 attacks, but we had the anthrax thing and so forth. So it was clear that doing what they planned to do was illegal under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was passed in the 1970s. And there was also some question about whether or not it was in conflict with the Fourth Amendment, which, you know, guarantees us protection against unreasonable searches and seizures by the government. And the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was passed in 1978 specifically forbade the monitoring of American citizens and U.S. Residents, not just citizens, but residents also, without a showing in court of probable cause. Now, clearly, I mean, if you're dealing with, you know, a terrorist, an unknown terrorist network within your own borders, you can't really be getting warrants to go look and see what they're up to. So everyone understood that these laws were obsolete, and no one objected very much when this program began. And it began really in 2003. John Poindexter, who was an admiral who had been long connected with intelligence developments, proposed to the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in 2003 a new system of integrating telecommunications data and analyzing, and it was called total information awareness. Basically, it works, you vacuum up everything, okay, then you store it, then you analyze it. Mm-hmm. Then when you detect patterns, then you can pursue other standard methods, going in, interrogating people, tapping their phones.
But now they're supposed to get a court order, right? In other words, they see a pattern of activity that connects. For example, in the Boston incident, there was no pattern of communications really with terrorists abroad. It was a homegrown thing. And they could tell that could go back to that. But they're supposed to get a court order, right? Before they can look, they can see the pattern, but before they can actually open it up, they're supposed to have a court order.
We didn't mind not getting warrants so much. It was not even having any court look at it.
Well, that's, we all thought that there's Foreign Intelligence Act was modified in 2007-2008. It was actually modified in 2007, but it had a sunset provision which was overturned in 2008. It's now permanent. Basically, what it says is you go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is for just judges appointed by the Supreme Court whose identities are secret. And you say, this is what we want to do. Is this okay? And they say yes, and then you do it. But they don't authorize individual intelligence
gathering.
They authorize huge blocks of data collection, but anyway, to go back to how this actually works, I mean, the basic model was brilliantly simple. You have most modern telecommunications, even those like telephones that we thought were analog, are now digital, and they all operate on a single system of encoding, and they all travel through microwave relays and through fiber optic internet trunks. Doesn't matter whether it's voice data or whether it's email or what it is. It's all divided up into packets and sent through these fiber optic networks. And there's huge amounts of data. Someone said that the basic fiber optic internet trunk that crosses the United States can transmit the contents of the Library of Congress every 3 seconds. That's how much data is flowing through. So there's no way you can capture this data and analyze it using traditional methods. So what they did with this total information awareness was to try and set up a system where they could do this monitoring, storage, and analysis, but the pieces weren't in place at the time. And Congress was immediately lobbied by civil liberties advocates who claimed that just vacuuming up all this data from American citizens as well as from foreign intelligence sources violated the Fourth Amendment and these laws. And the uproar was so great that Congress defunded the total information awareness proposal program, the initial program with DARPA. They defunded it in 2004. But meanwhile, the pieces of it that people were working on, it kept on being funded, and they were hosted by the NSA, the CIA, and the Defense Intelligence Agency, and they kept working on the various pieces of this. And as they developed them and improved upon them, they started looking around for computer hardware to support them and for an architecture that would put all of these pieces in place. Now, the interesting thing is, as near as we can tell from the information that's being provided, not only by leakers but also by legitimate sources, not all of these pieces are in place. Still, even today, it's clear what the ultimate architecture is going to be. But let's go back now to to 2004-2005, a fellow by the name of Mark Klein, who was a data technician at AT&T headquarters in San Francisco, discovered that the NSA was installing a whole bunch of equipment in a room next to the, you know, in the headquarters that he worked. And he looked into it a little, and he discovered that what they were doing was they were taking all of the traffic that was passing through that node, that AT&T node, and sending it somewhere to the NSA.
The FBI, is, I worked for AT&T and in the 60s in New York, and the first, it's very easy to tap into somebody's phone. You have a little earphone, and you put it in the frame room, and you can hear what everybody's saying. The thing is that what everybody's saying is totally boring. We were looking for lines that existed that weren't distant. But the guys I worked with, the union guys, showed me a room that they said that the FBI had been monitoring phones in New York City. They had their own room, sort of like what you're talking about here, and they had left, and nobody knew why. But maybe they just moved to another frame room, or there are mega frame rooms, I guess you would.
Well, what's different about this is that the reason the AT&T headquarters was chosen, apparently, is that's where the overseas communications comes into the U.S. network. Because the U.S. invented the Internet, and because the architecture of the Internet developed in the United States, almost all foreign telecommunications, it's estimated 60-80% of them, come through the continental United States, and there are 15 nodes where they enter the country. Now, as it turns out, we've found out since that what the NSA was doing was putting something called semantic traffic analyzers on these incoming trunks and then transmitting the data to someplace. And these machines were built by a company called Naris, which was founded in Israel and is now a part of Boeing. And Naris originally developed these semantic traffic analyzers to help communications companies recover more revenue from the data that they were transmitting. And it does it by taking these disconnected Internet packets, reassembling them, and analyzing them so that the companies would know whether or not you're using video or you using email, and they can prorate their charges according to the kind of data you're using. That's what they were originally designed for. But when they were bought out by Boeing and given to NSA, what they do is they take all of these disconnected floods of packets that are coming in on these trunks, and they do preliminary analysis. They assign them to email or to telephone calls or to this or to that, and then that data stream goes to NSA. Now, we didn't know what they were doing with it at the time, but we've since found out that they were storing it all. And they're building a huge data storage place, over 1 million square feet, in Snowden, Utah, which is outside of Fort Williams, with its own power supply, power plant, and everything else. 1 million square feet. According to William Binney, who was in charge of NSA programs until he resigned in 2001, he was in charge of this kind of traffic analysis at NSA before he resigned in 2001, and he resigned because he thought that what they were planning to do was a violation of U.S. law, and so he resigned.
Yeah, and that's,
but anyway, the point is, now we know where it's going to go. This place is going to open in September 2013, and it can actually store every incoming data packet, not only on these fiber optic networks, but also from satellite transmissions,
right,
and all
the
rest.
Satellite stuff, everything. So it's not so much the listening, it's the storage and the analysis, and the fear that that it's not just terrorists. Don't forget, nobody here is against, you know, finding terrorists and protecting the United States. It's that so much data is domestic and can be used by nefarious people running this thing, the Department of Homeland Security, the NSA.
A couple of points. This is only something very, very large countries can do. It's not something Al-Qaeda can do. It's something the Chinese and the British and the Russians can do. They can do similar things. The Israelis have the capability to do this. So any copycat. Any of this stuff going on is going on in industrialized, highly technological countries, except that countries even like North Korea can focus enough technology to build, for example, an atom bomb.
Well, let's move on to the third part of this, and that's the analysis. Now, some of this preliminary analysis is conducted by these semantic traffic analyzers that are plugged in. When it gets to NSA, it's still basically undifferentiated. You know, you've got telephone calls, you know, you've got emails, you know, you've got this, you know, you've got that. And that's where the computer software pattern analysis algorithms come into play. Now, it's even with the kind of computers they have, it's a huge task to break this down further to look for, say, patterns that might be indicative of terrorist planning. So one of the other programs, this PRISM program that we're hearing about, apparently allows them to capture pre-analyzed data from computer companies who already, you know, are operating free email for everybody, and they're operating Facebook, and they're operating Apple has its own cloud. And there, the data that comes in from their customers is already pre-analyzed because, of course, they use that to target advertising to you and for various purposes connected with what they call customer service, right?
Right.
So this helps the NSA because when they look at this data, the patterns are more easily discoverable. And so it helps them then go back to the big data trove that comes in from the NARIS machines on the internet trunks to analyze the data further. Now, according to what General Alexander is saying and James Clapper is saying, this data just sits there and we do what's called minimization on it. We don't listen to your telephone calls or read your emails. What we do, though, is we look at who sent it, who received it, right, when it was sent, where it came, where geographically it came from, and where it went. And then we look for patterns. You know, if you call somebody in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen, and then you call three people, you know, in various places in the United States.
So what's wrong with that? That sounds fine.
Well, it may or may not be worth looking into. You have to look at further patterns. Because, of course, it may simply be some, you know, American citizen who has family in Yemen who's calling to see if grandma's okay.
In fact, they must get a whole lot of false positives of somebody who has a family member in Pakistan who's calling them on the phone and chatting about, you know, how the farm is doing back there or a business deal. So there's a fantastic amount of international commerce. They must get tons and tons of false positives, even if they're analyzing this very narrowly. They must get, I mean, it's 310 million people in the United States. How many in the world of several billion people using electronic communications?
The figure that's thrown about by William Binney and others is they have the capacity to collect 19 billion messages a day.
Okay. And the government says these sit there, they don't do anything with them unless there's a foreign intelligence reason to do it. In other words, you're an American operative of Al-Qaeda or some sort of extremist group, that's when they open the packet and see what you got, what you're saying to the guys in Yemen.
But I'm a paranoid American.
There you go.
Steve is going to run for office, and this whole thing is run, we're saying, by the government, but we're also hearing a lot about private contractors. So let's say the segment I want is run by a private contractor, and there's one guy there that's willing to sell me anything I want to know about Steve, so I can drop all kinds of nasty hints about him.
Well, that you get better commercially. But I think what Bill brought up, the organization that Snowden works on, is a privatization of our
intelligence. Well, it's interesting. Booz Allen and NARIS and a number of other organizations, you probably heard of one called Palantir, are all run by ex-generals and admirals like Mike McConnell,
right,
who used to be either the head of the CIA or the head of NSA or both.
I think he was the head of NSA.
And so, well, he was actually, Hayden was both. So what we're saying is if you got 1,400,000 people, which is the current figure, who have top secret security clearances, and half of them work for private contractors, and the security clearance is not vetted by the government, but by the contractor.
Right.
the potential for abuse here is substantial. But, you know, what is the difference between potential and actual abuse? We don't really know. I mean, and as far as we don't listen to your telephone calls, all we do is have the metadata. Metadata can often tell you as much or more than the content of the call. Let's just give, you know, one simple example. A woman calls her doctor for an appointment. Then she makes an appointment with a medical testing laboratory. Then she calls an oncology specialist. And several days after that, she calls her parents, her children, her ex-husband, some of her friends and relatives. And then she calls the family's financial advisor and a lawyer and a hospice service.
We can see what's happening there, yeah.
We know what this woman is facing, right?
Yeah.
And this is, you know, analyzing.
And we haven't listened to one conversation. We've just seen the pattern, and we're able to identify who she's talking to. This is an oncologist's office and so forth. Mm-hmm. And then we can learn a lot about what's going on without
even listening to the
conversations. Without listening to the conversations, which would be an ordeal.
Well, you know, you hear a lot of talk from the civil liberties advocates about the government invading our privacy. Nobody likes any, you know, the government looking over their shoulder. But privacy isn't really, I think, what we should be worrying about. What we should worry about is the potential misuse of this data collection and analysis to marginalize, demonize, or even criminalize legitimate political opponents
exactly.
of the government.
You know, it's only the people in this room, not the only, in the age group in this room, the young people don't worry about the loss of privacy. I mean, they all their stuff is out there on the internet. They say that's fine.
It's a complete contradiction. People on one hand want privacy. On the other hand, people want to be seen. The amount of stuff on Facebook about people is a total portrait. The ability to misuse that for criminals or corporations is extraordinary.
What you do is you get some, it's like opposition research in politics. You get something on somebody and then you go intimidate them. And they don't have to be terrorists. They just have to be people that you don't like. I mean, Nixon's enemies list. Nixon with his plumbers breaking into Democratic Party headquarters, or Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Daniel Ellsberg wasn't a terrorist. He leaked secret government data, but he wasn't a terrorist. And it was, you know, in those days, that kind of thing was totally illegal. Probably would be now, too. But nowadays, if you wanted that kind of information on Daniel Ellsberg, you could, theoretically, just call the NSA director and say, hey, you know, give me everything this guy's been up to. So
I want to underscore that political use of the metadata, that storing the data is the key here, and I think that's the thing we brought out here this morning.
I think what Bill's saying is, I mean, you could go back to everybody Daniel Ellsberg, in those days they couldn't do it, called on the telephone, and then you could track the whole thing.
Is there any evidence that the government has been doing this sort of thing already? Well, there's not a whole lot, and it's not conclusive, but there are some disturbing signs, like an anti-war nun who's put on a no-fly list, a U.S. documentary filmmaker who had her laptop and cell phone seized as she was coming into the country and was detained upwards of 40 times as she traveled in and out of the United States. I mean, she's not a terrorist. She's no threat.
And, yeah, she made award-winning movies, The Oath, My Country, My Country.
And there's even some evidence that people planning peaceful demonstrations at the Republican Convention of 2008 in Minneapolis were identified and located from their internet communications, rounded up and put in preventive detention as potential terrorists 24 hours before the convention began. So it's something, we don't know what all the truth is, but we think there's enough of it out there that people should pay closer attention to whether or not we really do have congressional oversight of these programs.
The surveillance thing is complex, and we tried to clear it up. I'm not sure we did a whole lot, but we did cover at least a few points this morning about, and we did so on behalf of some of our friends at Democrats of the Red Rocks that help us out, and Democrats of the Verde Valley that also help us out.
You can hear Bill's presentation probably this Thursday as a podcast, and we listen to it. And I think he's going to provide a whole lot of written material about the research he's done on this issue.
VVID.org is where you can hear it. VVID.org. We have this podcast and all our podcasts, all our excellent content that can be found there. Thank you, guys. Did a good job.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.